Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 16 of the Ad Nauseam Podcast. My name is Jeff Winkle. I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Dr. Dave Noe. How you doing today, Dave?
Doing really well. Jeff, how about you?
I'm doing just fine. It's a little cold here in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Days are getting shorter. Have you noticed that?
I've noticed that.
We're winding down to the winter solstice.
Exactly. So not a lot of daylight here.
No.
It's a little gloomy outside today here in Grand Rapids, chilly.
Right.
But as always, warm and balmy here in the vomitorium.
Yeah, I wake up and walk to my mailbox, and by the time I get back, the sun is already setting.
It That's how it goes. It's brutal.
So what are we covering today, Jeff?
Before we get to that, I think we have a shout out.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course.
Wait, would you take care of that for us?
Yeah. So I want to say hello to Mr. Timothy Dubois. Timothy is listening from nearby Grand Rapids, Michigan, actually.
Excellent.
A recent addition to our podcast audience. Very grateful, Timothy, that you're on board. Jeff, we're covering Euripides, aren't we?
We are covering Euripides today. We're talking a bit about Greek tragedy as a whole. We're going to be talking about Euripides, the poet, the playwright, and get into one of his... I go back and forth, but it could be my favorite work of his, his play, The Alcestis.
The Alcestis.
Yes. But before we do that, I think you got an opening quote to share with us today, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I have a quote here from the most brilliant biologist ever to study poetry, that is Aristotle.
Exactly.
And Aristotle says, this is in the Poetics, 1453, that's the section number translated by Fife. Always like to mention the translator. And Aristotle says, there is very good evidence for this, namely that Euripides is a good tragedian, for on the stage and in competitions, such plays, that is those of Euripides, appear the most tragic of all, if they are successful. And even if Euripides is in other respects a bad manager, yet he is certainly the most tragic of the poets. Jeff, can you unpack that for our listeners a little bit? What does he mean?
Well, I think that if people know something about Aristotle and his breakdown of tragedy, you might know that Sophocles was his preferred poet. He liked the way that he structured his plays. He thought that Sophocles' plays were the most effective, the most perfect. And Euripides, again, through Aristotle's eyes, is a bit messy.
Okay.
So when he calls him a bad manager, I take that to mean, Aristotle had a problem with it that he would structure his plays. You know, by the end of the third act, you might say, it's a bit of a tangled mess. And one of the famous things about Euripides' plays is that he would often bring in a god.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, to paraphrase and to paint with a broad brush, the god comes in and says, this play's over because I'm a god. And
right.
So he didn't tie up the loose ends in the way that Sophocles might.
The deus ex machina.
Yes.
The god who's lowered down from the crane on a wire. And as you said, basically resolves all plot conflicts and outstanding issues by saying, I'm going to exercise my divine power.
Right. In terms of literary criticism, it's lazy. It's a bit of a cop-out.
Right. Yeah. On the other hand, Aristotle does say that Euripides is the most tragic of the poets. What does he mean by that? And specifically, Jeff, what are we going to be offering our listeners today in terms of what they can take away from this episode to enrich themselves and make themselves more astute students of ancient poetry?
Sure. One of the big takeaways from this episode is a better understanding, a deeper understanding of that third of the big three. Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides are the three Greek tragedians whose works survive intact and in some form, at least. And I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I think Euripides always comes off as the odd man out.
Definitely.
To some degree. But at the same time, and I think this is getting around to maybe Aristotle's view of him as the most tragic of poets. To me, in some ways, he reads the most modernly. He touches a nerve. He has a finger on some aspect of humanity, perhaps, a realism, perhaps, that you don't find in Aeschylus and Sophocles.
Definitely. So one of the things that we'll notice as we move through this episode is that, unlike the other two greats whom you've already mentioned, Euripides has characters that are more relatable. He has commoners, you might say, in a lot of his plays. And I understand, Jeff, that we have a quote coming up from Aristophanes, the comedian, who points out some of the differences between the three greats. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about the background of tragedy. Where did it come from, and how did it develop in Athens?
Yeah, let's do it. We were talking earlier, we're going to devote in the future a full episode to this, but I think this is worthwhile going through, at least in some regard, to set us up for who was Euripides and then talking about this play.
So my understanding, Jeff, of the origins of tragedy is that it is one of those literary mysteries.
Yes, but we don't exactly know where it comes from. It's like a lot of those cultural pieces that if you go back far enough in history, you get into that fog of myth, of tradition, where it's really hard to kind of pin down historical truths.
There's no real clear origin story for tragedy and for the comedy that seems to have developed either right alongside of it or immediately after. But a scholar that I particularly like, maybe it's because his work is in the public domain and I'm a cheapskate, a man that we've mentioned before, the late H.J. Rose.
Yeah.
He gives three reasons for the development of tragedy, or the development of drama generally at Athens. You ready for these?
Yeah, lay it on.
Okay, so the first one is geographical position. So Rose says, Athens was situated uniquely between these three continents, Europe, Asia, Africa, and it was at a kind of a crossroads within the Greek world itself, between Ionia to the east, Boeotia to the north, good for cows, and the Peloponnesus to the south and to the west.
I like that. I'm often very persuaded by kind of geography as destiny arguments.
Yes, I am too.
Yeah.
Because the place where you are shapes you in a lot of significant ways.
Right.
Second reason is competition. And I think there's really no doubt about this, that the Greeks generally, Athens in particular, highly agonistic, a theme we talked about in our episodes on Homer. So the Greeks, given to competition, the early tragedies were all staged in such a way that they were competitive.
Right. I think that's something that often surprises students, that in some ways these plays were, in the Greek mind, kind of like this. This is your javelin throw, your sprint. And so you're going head-to-head with other playwrights, and you either win or you lose. I guess we know we still have some of that competitive aspect, you know, like I guess the Oscars are putting, you know,
yes,
movies against each other.
And the Cannes Film Festival and those kinds of
right.
things.
Right. But we tend not to think of the arts as being competitive. Around here in Grand Rapids, we have this, well, it used to be an annual art prize.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that how that bugged some of the art historians at the institution we were teaching at
okay.
the time. They did not like the kind of the reduction of art to competition. But
right.
that was inherent in Athenian culture.
Yes. And so maybe another distinction is that we're used to competition in a kind of rarefied air, perhaps, when you think of things like the film festivals and so forth. Those films don't always make it to general consumption. They're aimed at a very small audience, some
right.
of them, with particular interests. But the ancient tragedies, these were extremely popular. Everyone in Athens saw them.
Right. And I think for, say, maybe a contemporary audience, the thing that bothers that kind of the competitiveness of art is that it's so subjective. You can't
right.
measure it in time and feet, right?
That's what some say, yes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the third reason, Jeff, that Rose gives for the development of tragedy, drama at Athens, is the expansion of Athenian power. Here's the money angle, you might say.
Exactly. So the Greeks, or the Athenians in particular, kind of rise to the top of the heap following the Greco-Persian Wars.
Right.
They find themselves flush with cash, flush with influence. And so you can build the big theaters. You can support the arts in a way that, you know, in times of woe and want, you can't.
Right. So after they defeated, well, they led the confederation, the loose confederation, along with the Spartans, defeated the Persians, 479, the Battle of Plataea mopped up. For the next 50 years under Pericles' leadership, huge flowering of the arts. They took all that money from the island of Delos, from the league that was set up to defend against the Persians, and
right.
they spent it on public architecture like the Parthenon, and they channeled a lot of the money toward the arts.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff that you can still see in Athens still
Definitely.
Standing. Right, that golden age, you know, the roughly 500 to 400 BC is that, it's the golden age of so many things that we think of, we associate with the ancient Greeks, but that's the heyday of tragedy as well.
So Jeff, with those three elements in mind, the three potential reasons, according to Rose, why drama arose in Athens in particular, let's move on to some of the particulars of tragedy and its performance.
Sure.
So one of the things that surprises contemporary audiences, at least in my experience when I teach these authors, is how few actors were involved in the production.
Right.
Typically, actors filled multiple roles. They would run off the stage, change costume, and come back on as a different individual. Same actor, but playing a different role.
Right. And I mean, there's so much that we don't know about
That's true.
Kind of how there, we know there was likely choreography, of course, music. You know, did actors, you know, who were male playing female parts, did they adjust their voice?
Yeah, did they use a falsetto? There's some reason to believe that.
Right. So some have compared maybe that ancient tragedy looked, maybe sounded a lot like maybe opera is the best referent. But you're right. It strikes the contemporary eye as odd. You know, a few actors wearing masks. You know how could this be enjoyable? How could this be powerful?
Right. Sometimes they're wearing almost a stilt, a boot, so they can be seen in all parts of the theater to give them a greater height and grandeur. These are some of the theories about how these plays were performed. There's a protagonist, right? Typically three actors. There's a deuteragonist and a tritagonist, the first actor, the second, and the third.
Right. And most plays that survive have two. That by tradition, it's Sophocles who adds the third actor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much a pared down production. You're not having tons of actors running back and forth and interacting with each other on stage.
Right. And we haven't even touched on perhaps the most unusual element, which is the chorus.
Right. So one of the theories, or at least the kind of the mythical story, is that tragedy grew out of choral performance.
Right.
So it began as, and again, we'll talk about this in a future episode, but out of this choral performance called the dithyram.
Right. Kind of like call and response, right?
Yes.
In blues.
Exactly right. And so the story goes, the kind of the quasi-mythical Thespis, from whom we get the term thespian, he was the guy that stepped out of the chorus and responded to the group singing with an individual song. And so voila, you have drama.
We also have to remember, Jeff, that none of these productions had extensive scenery, background, lighting, special effects, anything like that.
Not at all. If the tradition is true, tragedy, drama began at the bottom of a hillside. The spectators gathering on the hill and the performers performing in the dirt at the bottom of the hill.
Right.
Now, the tragic space, the theater, which the Greeks are rightly famous for developing, its acoustic elements and the like, develop as tragedy and comedy develop, but it was very sparse.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very simple, a simple space.
And of course, one of the implications of this is that with the actors wearing masks, with little or no scenery, all the emotion, all the information we have about time of day and so forth, this has to be conveyed by the text itself.
Exactly. I remember once, a number of years ago, being at a conference in Chapel Hill on Greek tragedy, and there was a session done by the Aquila theater group. Have you heard of Aquila?
I don't think so.
They do lots of kind of restaging of Greek tragedies and comedies and the like. And
are they British?
British, exactly.
I think I did see a production of Aristophanes they did once.
Yeah, they do a lot of really interesting stuff, and they'll do a lot of productions kind of in the severe tragic ancient style with masked actors. And I remember at this session they were kind of addressing the question of how could that work as an actor? Don't you lose so much range if people can't see your face?
Mm-hmm.
And
if you're wearing a mask, right.
Exactly right. And I remember the director there was kind of theorizing how this may have worked, and he picked this young woman from the audience and he gave her this mask with this raggedy wig, and she was playing kind of an old beggar woman, and he kind of bent her arms and twisted her legs and gave her kind of a cup with coins to rattle. And I remember having her walk up and down the rows of this theater that we in, not making any sound, not doing anything, but just kind of shaking that cup and kind of lurching along almost zombie-like.
Hmm.
And his whole point was, you don't need necessarily dialogue, you don't need a facial expression to convey something really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that has anything to do with how actual ancient tragedy looked is a whole other question, but that's always stuck with me.
It is one of the leading theories of how it worked, of course.
Right.
And these masks, we should state, were types of characters. So you had certain stereotypes, like the old man, the young woman, and that was what conveyed to the audience the identity of the character,
mm-hmm.
of the individual. So we've talked about a number of elements of tragedy. What about Aristotle's really interesting observation? We got to get on to Euripides' biography, but we can't skip over this really interesting point.
Why don't you read this for us? This is
right,
great.
So this is the Butcher translation of Aristotle's Poetics, and he says, "Poetry, therefore, is a more philosophical and a higher thing than history." Let that sink in a minute. Poetry is more philosophical and a higher thing than history. And here's the reason. Poetry tends to express the universal, history the particular.
Yeah. So we've touched on this in a couple of earlier episodes, but this idea that for the ancient Greeks, if you wanted to say something really serious, if you wanted to say something that, if you wanted to teach the people, you did it through poetry.
Correct.
Which is probably the opposite of what most people would think today.
Definitely. As I encounter people who are serious about history of thought and so forth. They're serious about politics. They're serious about religion and philosophy. They think in historical terms almost exclusively.
Right.
They want to know what happened. They want to have a really clear sense of what happened. Aristotle would say, well, that's interesting, but it's a lower type of literature than poetry because it deals with the particular things that happened in particular places. But poetry can teach you what ought to happen in any given circumstance, as well as what's going to happen. That seems to be the idea underlying his thought.
Yeah, and to me, it's no coincidence that tragedy develops or has its kind of moment in the sun just as Socrates and Plato are getting going. Mm-hmm. And what we think of Greek philosophical thought also having its moment in the sun. And we tend to put these things in these silos. You know, you have tragedy over here, history over here, philosophy over here. I mean, I think to the Greek mind, watching a play was another way of doing philosophy,
mm-hmm.
right? The tragedian was known as a sophos.
Right.
One of the jobs of the tragedian was to teach the people.
Right, explain the universals of human nature, how the gods interact with men and women, how family dynamics work, and these sorts of things.
Right, but we got to get down to Euripides.
Absolutely.
Right? We got to talk about the man himself.
So according to tradition, Euripides was born on September 23 in the year 480. And of course, Jeff, this is the very date of the famous Battle of Salamis.
Do you buy it?
Well, it's suspicious, right? One of the ways that ancient authors tried to link together important persons and important events was to put their birth and death dates coterminous.
It reminds me of, I'm forgetting the name of the musician, the guitarist who claimed to have been born the day Jimi Hendrix died.
Oh, I don't know that guy.
I think if I remembered his name, you'd know who I'm talking about. But it's the same kind of idea, is that one great event or
right.
one monumental event gives way to another.
I did hear a story about Joe Satriani.
Please.
We'd love to have Satch as a sponsor. Joe Satriani quitting the football team and devoting himself to guitar full time the day that Jimi Hendrix died.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking. That could
it
be
could
what I'm
be.
Thinking of. But
you spend a lot of time reading about Satriani's biography, don't you?
Well, I love those kind of those little urban legends.
Right.
But this seems to fall right in line with that.
Well, I think so because it connects an important person with an important event.
Yeah.
Helps us then remember. So born in 480, September 23 or some other date, what happened to him after he was born?
Well, he lived a long, fruitful life. Well, actually, we don't know a lot about his life. Right? We don't know a lot about his biography.
So born in 480, September 23, or some date. Jeff, what happened to him after he was born?
Well, he was very likely, almost assuredly, born to privilege.
Okay.
There's not a lot of evidence for a lot of social mobility in ancient Athens. So to have had the career track that he did, he most likely came from a wealthy, influential family. What else do we know about him?
Well, he was influenced by the rise of the Sophistic movement, as it's called. Anaxagoras, pre-Socratic philosopher, and then Socrates, a Socratic philosopher. The two of them had a certain amount of influence on Euripides, it seems. He was married twice, had three children, gained tremendous personal wealth, and he was a bit of a traveler.
We know he went to Syracuse.
Went to Macedon.
Macedon.
To the court of Archelaus, the first very important potentate.
Right.
Up north.
In some ways, Euripides maybe had a sense of kind of where things were going. It's in the north in Macedon where
you're talking about geopolitics.
Geopolitics, right, where the next wave of power and influence is coming from. And, you know, ultimately with the rise of Alexander the Great.
Those people up in Macedon, right, as Demosthenes tells us, they're wandering around wearing bearskins and so forth. And they're a wild lot. So what are they going to do?
Right.
They're going to hire someone like Euripides who brings a little patina of culture.
That's
to the
right.
wild court
yeah.
at I mean, Pella.
They were drinking milk up there, for goodness sake.
That's what we read.
Wild
yeah.
men, yes.
So how many of his plays survive?
The official count is 18. Sometimes you'll see the number 19. I think there's one play that is still bandied about by academics that could be or couldn't be, but 18 plays survive. And so in some ways in the number...
They bandy it about?
They bandy the argument about. You know,
I see.
Is it Euripidean, is it not? That's what I'm saying.
It's a parlor game among scholars and classicists.
There's just lots of bandying going on.
It's wild
on.
Stuff, isn't
it's
it?
It's wild stuff. So in terms of the numbers game, Euripides wins. He has 18 plays that survive. Aeschylus and Sophocles, 7 each.
However, ancient sources tell us that Euripides wrote more than 92.
Yes, a ton of plays. And Aeschylus and Sophocles, too, a tremendous number to their name.
Very, very prolific.
Prolific. Yeah, that's, I mean, if you think about Euripides have started writing plays maybe in his 20s.
Mm-hmm. So along about 460, 455, something like
so
that.
So he's cranking out more than two plays a year.
Yep.
To the end of his life. It's incredible. It's humbling.
What does that mean, Jeff? Are you not cranking out many plays?
I'm nowhere near that prolific. I wish I was that prolific.
Are there legends, Jeff, about how Euripides died? What's going on there?
Oh, this great corner of mythology, these death stories of poets.
You say of mythology or history?
Well, this is almost assuredly not true.
Okay, tell us more.
This has got to be another episode, so I don't want to get into
all the details.
Well,
if we keep telling the audience that this is going to be another episode, they're going to stop listening to this one.
No, they're going to keep listening to find out.
All right.
That's what they're going to do. So one of the stories about Euripides is that he goes up to Macedon, possibly because of the reception that he received in Athens. So there's this tradition about Euripides that he's the guy they love to hate.
The poor reception. Okay.
Yes. And so he goes up there and he dies in self-exile up there. And one of the stories that is that he was out wandering one day out on the hillsides, possibly composing in his head his next tragedy, and he's set upon by a pack of wild dogs and torn apart.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
So he's the absent-minded professor kind of type, right?
Yeah, exactly. So some people think that, you know, the Athenians created that story because that was a fitting death for the guy they didn't like. It also seems to mimic what happens to Pentheus in his play The Bacchae.
Right.
So it's kind of art becoming life. So there's lots of reason to be suspicious of the story as a historical event. It's more about kind of how the Athenians perhaps viewed him.
Mm-hmm. And the three great, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, each of them has a traditional moniker or title that's attached to them. So Aeschylus is known as the traditionalist.
The traditionalist?
Yes. So he's closest in temperament based on such readings as Oliver Taplin and Hugh Lloyd-Jones and other scholars. He's closest in temperament to Homer. This is the Homeric world that Aeschylus represents.
Right. And he's a full generation before Euripides and Sophocles. And so I think it's also part of, you know, who Aeschylus was, that he's writing during really that kind of the heyday of the Athenian Empire.
It's the close of the archaic smile as well.
Yes. And so he's writing at a time where Athens is ascendant after the Persian Wars. Athens is becoming rich and wealthy and confident, and he dies really before things start to fall apart with the Peloponnesian War.
And before the rise of the Socratic movement and the Sophistic movement.
Exactly.
So all of this careful inspection and analysis of Athenian power and so forth.
Right.
And Sophocles straddles the middle point. This is how it's traditionally understood. He's what's called the existentialist. So he has traditional values and ideas in many ways, and yet he's beginning to experiment with some of the rawness of human experience.
Right. He writes after the Athenian plague. Arguably his most famous play, Oedipus the King, is premiered the year after.
Seems like 429.
429. So right on the heels of this deadly plague, which kills off by some estimates a third of the Athenian populace. And so it's a huge pulling out of the rug underneath the feet in terms of, you know, where are the gods? What's happening?
And then third, Euripides.
Yes.
Where does he fit?
He is sometimes called the realist.
Okay.
And so he too very likely affected, like you were saying earlier, the Sophist movement, questioning of kind of foundational truths. He sees Athens kind of flailing during the Peloponnesian War. Sometimes I've heard him described as being the first kind of postmodern. He's pre-modern, but he's postmodern in that he's all over the map in terms of considering the question of what can we rely on, what can we trust on, where are the gods, who are the gods.
The different qualities and characters of these three tragedians, very artfully expressed in the comedy by Aristophanes, The Frogs. And Jeff, I understand you've translated a little bit of this yourself.
I have.
Can you share with us a few lines from this in the relevant portion?
Sure. So this comes at a part in the play where, well, the god Dionysus, who is the god of tragedy, is going down into Hades to bring ostensibly Euripides back, because there's no good tragedians left back on Earth. But when he gets down there, the plot devolves into this contest between Euripides and Aeschylus, who's dead and down there as well, having kind of a head-to-head tragedy battle.
Now, Sophocles is still alive,
right,
for a few more months in the world above, and the representative of traditionalism, Aeschylus, is going against Euripides, the most modern of the three.
Exactly, and they tear each other apart. It's quite wonderful. So in this section, Euripides and Aeschylus are kind of heating up their argument. So let me read a little bit. So Euripides says, "Look, I've watched and studied this guy, Aeschylus for decades. His character's crass and tongueless and toothless. His mouth is a maelstrom of guttural gribble-grabble grobbly grunk. And Aeschylus responds, "Oh, is that right, you son of a garden goddess? You have the nerve to say that about me? You rag-stitching, gossip-kvetching, beggar-bewitching mountebank, you'll pay for this." Dionysus interjects. He says, "Calm down, Aeschylus. You'll pop an ulcer." Aeschylus, "I will not calm down. Not before I reveal this poet of cripples and freaks for who he really is."
So you really enjoyed translating this.
Oh, I did. This is so much fun.
Yeah, Aristophanes is brilliant, isn't he?
He's great.
And he really puts his finger on the difference between these two individuals, Aeschylus and Euripides. Aeschylus with these massive, untranslatable compound nouns and adjectives. Euripides with all of his characters dressed up in rags and kings on stage, but they look like beggars and women and people crying and all of this tragic effect.
Yeah. All right. Now the stage is set. We can finally get down to this specific play.
I'm looking forward to it.
But before we get there, we have to hear from our sponsors. And we're also going to hear, we'll have kind of a special bit from an outside translator.
Yes. This episode of Ad Nauseam is brought to you in part by Hackett Publishing. Since 1972, Hackett has been an independent publisher of high-quality translations in the field of classics, as well as many other corners of the humanities. Jeff, can you tell our listeners about some of the work Hackett has to offer?
I can. Hackett's growing classics list includes hundreds of titles covering ancient history, literature, philosophy, political science, and classical language study. Hackett editions are ideal for both classroom use and general readership, offering affordable modern translations and editions of classic works with helpful scholarly notes, annotations, and introductions.
I like their classical literature backlist, including translations like the Iliad and Odyssey, Virgil's Aeneid, the Metamorphoses, and even a new verse rendering of Gilgamesh.
Dave, why don't you drop the goods on our loyal listeners? What's the dessert here at Shea A.N.?
From now until December 31st, Ad Nauseam listeners can save 20% on any order and receive free shipping from Hackett Publishing. All you have to do is go to Hackett Publishing, that's two T's, H-A-C-K-E-T-T, find the text you want, and enter the code AN2020 in the box which asks for the coupon code.
That's a great deal. Don't hesitate. Check out HackettPublishing.com today.
Today's episode is also brought to you by our good friends at Ratio Coffee. Hey, Jeff, have you ever had a bad cup of coffee?
Oh, been there, done that.
Been there, done that. Did you pay someone to write that dad joke for you? Seriously, though, does coffee play a role in your life as a teacher?
No doubt. Nothing better than a stiff cup when I have a big stack of papers to grade.
Same goes for me. And thanks to the good people at Ratio Coffee of Portland, Oregon, I no longer have to slurp bilge water as I stumble to class. Now I get to savor every premium, delicious sip from that automatic pour-over wonder.
You want to talk about the Ratio 8, don't you?
Oh, yes, and its little brother, the 6. These two are the veritable titans of home coffee brewing. Made of all premium quality material and a heating element forged in the heart of the sun.
Wow.
Why spend $6 every day at your local coffee shop on some tepid brew when you can have this baby sitting on your countertop at home, the envy of all the neighborhood baristas? Jeff, why don't you tell our listeners about the great deal that Ratio is giving them exclusively?
Ad Nauseam listeners can get a direct-to-consumer discount by going to ratiocoffee.com and entering our special code, ANCO. Get 15% off the Ratio 6 between now and March 20, 2021. Go to ratiocoffee.com and enter in special code ANCO for 15% off the Ratio 6.
So, Jeff, as we get right into the play, The Alcestis, now, we have a special treat this week.
We do.
We have a portion of the play read in Greek by the translator of the Hackett edition. My good friend, the scholar, Dr. Diane Arnson-Sfarlian, is going to read a little bit of the prologue in Greek for us.
And then you're going to translate it afterwards?
Yes, I'll read some of her translation, which is wonderful.
Sounds great.
O domat ad mete, en hois etlenego, thesan trapezan ainesai, theos per on, zeuskar, Kataktas paida tonemon aetios, asclepion, sternoisen embalon floga, hude holothes tectonas diu purroscteno cuclopas, caime theteuen pater thnetoi par andri tond apoin enancasen. Elthon de gaiantend ebuforbun xenoi, kai tond esoison oikon, es tod hemeras. Hosiugar anduros hosioson, et tunchanon paidos feretos. Hon, thanen, erusamen, moiras dolosas.
So here we have Dr. Arntzen Svarlian's translation of those beautiful lines. Apollo says, "Here is Admetus' house, where I endured a seat of honor at the servant's table, although I am a god. Zeus was the cause. He killed my son Asclepius with a blast of lightning to the chest. Enraged for him, I killed the Cyclopes, who forged the bolts of Zeus. My father paid me back for that by forcing me to serve a mortal man. I came to this land, tended this man's cattle, was treated like a guest, and to this day I have preserved his household. I have found that Pheres' son is holy, like myself."
So what I love about this is that we have Apollo in this subservient role. He's been a slave of Admetus, or servant of Admetus, for the last year. And so we have that kind of topsy-turviness going on. And we also have this description of Admetus himself as being holy. Apollo uses language of the gods to describe Admetus, and I think any reader of this play would certainly see that Admetus is in many ways anything but holy.
Yes, that's exactly why I'm drawn to this play as well, and why we chose to talk about it today. We have such a startling contrast between the woman Alcestis. She is the lovely, devoted wife of her husband Admetus, the king, the son of Pheres. And the deal is, someone in this family has to die. Someone has to die because of what Apollo has done. And instead of having Admetus die, who is the most likely candidate, Alcestis dies in his place. Is it that, Jeff, which strikes you about this play, or is it something else?
There's so much in this play that strikes me. I love how the play has tragic elements mixed with comic elements. It's pure Euripides play, where he will pull you in one direction and then in the next moment pull you in the other direction and leaves you with that haunting open-endedness. In the next episode, we'll talk about the ending of the play, which I think is the most fascinating part of this, and just how it could be interpreted in two radically different ways. And so it leaves these haunting echoes. And so I like how this play leaves me unsettled.
That's fascinating. So the prologue that we just read sets up the basic outlines of the plot. Let's rehearse that a little bit for the listener so they can keep track. Because as we were saying before, these Euripidean plots are a little bit complicated.
They are complicated. And Euripides in this play tells you more or less what you need to know. I think that I would make the argument that the backstory for this play is even more essential for understanding kind of how the play ends than most any other tragedy. So Apollo lays it out here. He's been sentenced by Zeus to be a servant for Admetus for a year because he reacted in anger after Zeus kills Asclepius. So Asclepius is Apollo's son. What Apollo doesn't mention here is Asclepius had raised Hippolytus from the dead.
Okay.
And
that's a no-no.
That's a no-no, right? You don't do that. And so by the kind of the calculus of fate and death, if some person dies before their time, then that has to be, the other side of the ledger has to be balanced.
So Asclepius raised someone from the dead, and now someone has to die.
Exactly. Yep. Apollo, angered by the death of his son, retaliates. You can't kill Zeus. So he kills the Cyclopes, which fashion his thunderbolts. So Zeus finally says, all right, time out. And sends Apollo down for a year to serve Admetus to cool off.
And this is a kind of humiliation for him.
Yes.
And what happens then?
Well, then we learn that Admetus, his host, his death day is imminent. So Apollo, who has been treated well by Admetus, and we'll see this is something that Admetus is celebrated for, but it's also a big part of his problem. He's almost too good of a host.
He can't say no.
He can't say no. He's a people pleaser. And so Apollo says, you know, what could I do to thank this guy for this year? Really not treating me as a slave at all. So he learns through the fates, or by reading the fates, that Admetus is to die. So I think Apollo tells us that he tricks the fates, finds a loophole, and tells Admetus that, listen, you don't have to die, but what you have to do is find somebody to die in your place.
Hmm. So that's really the crux of the play.
That is.
Admetus is to die because of this squabbling and backstory with Apollo and Zeus and so forth. Admetus is supposed to die. He can escape his designated day of death if he finds a substitute.
That's exactly right. So Apollo drops this quote-unquote gift on him, but that's the first domino that leads to this chaos that follows.
So then Apollo says, at the end of the prologue, This is the day, you see, the fated end. I'm leaving now, lest I become infected by death's miasma in this house I love. Already I see Thanatos approaching, priest of the perished, death himself. He's here to take her down to the house of Hades. Now this moment has come, the day he's waited for.
So death itself approaches.
Yes, death himself, death. Personified.
Right.
Comes, and he's here to collect Alcestis.
Yeah, and this is a rare moment. I don't think there's any other place in the Greek corpus where death appears as kind of this walking, talking creature. You see it. You see Thanatos depicted in art,
right,
at the moment of someone's death. But this is an example of one.
Now, death is not pleased that Apollo was there, and they have a little exchange, a back and forth, a conflict. How does this go?
So the death is upset. He sees Apollo coming and suspects that he's, again, messing in his business, doing what Apollo does, apparently, dropping this bomb and then taking off. Death is upset. He says, I have my rights. I have what's due to me. And Apollo threatens that. He threatens to kind of rob death of his due.
So after this back and forth, right near the end of this back and forth between Apollo and death, it becomes clear that Apollo is going to have to yield. Thanatos, death, he's going to get his due.
He is.
But Apollo has a little bit of an escape clause.
He does. So he says, and here I'm reading from my own translation, he says to death, "Even so, mark my words, dear death, you will stop from your hateful ways. In fact, at this very moment, there's a man on his way here to the house of fairies to do just that. Eurystheus has sent him up to Thrace to fetch the horses and chariot from the dread king who lives there. He will stop here as a guest, and he will accomplish exactly what I want. He will take the woman from you. The difference is that this time you'll receive no thanks from me, only hatred. You had your chance."
So this, of course, Jeff, is a reference to Hercules.
Yes.
He's the man from Tiryns. He's got 12 laborers, and one of them, I believe it's the eighth.
That's right, yep.
Is that he's going to fetch the man-eating mares of Diomedes.
Yes, up in wild Thrace.
Way off in the north somewhere. Now, this Diomedes is a son of Mars, and it is one of his 12 labors. But this is an opportunity for the poet to tell us about a side trip. What, for Herculean scholars and devotees, and who isn't, is called a parergon.
Exactly right. Heracles is one of those heroes where it seems that authors and poets love to kind of ask the question, well, what happened between these points? His tree of legends grows and grows and grows. It's also clear that he and Admetus have some sort of long-standing friendship. And so
pen pals, maybe?
Yeah, pen pals. And so he's going to stop off and see his buddy.
Right. So this parergon then, as he's on his way to Thrace, is a good opportunity for him to help out Admetus. And Apollo predicts, because he's the god of prophecy, death is going to lose, Hercules is going to stop by, he's going to rescue Alcestis, and that sets up the action for the rest of the play. So the prologue is over, we have the basic outline of the plot now. Mm-hmm. Enter then the chorus, and how does the chorus set the tone for the play?
So this is what is called the parados, the kind of the entrance of the chorus, kind of the big song, the show-stopping number to some degree. But they sing a kind of a dirge here, and kind of express kind of the funeral aspect of the house.
So the house is completely in mourning because they know Alcestis is dying. Mm-hmm. How does the chorus express that, Jeff?
They sing, "The house of Admetus is unsettling still. The whole of the town is wrapped in an unsettling chill. What's more is there's nobody coming outside to tell us if Peleus' daughter has died. Living or dead, we all would agree she's the best of all wives, obviously. Did you hear a groan? I'm afraid to have asked. Or the rending of clothing to signal she's passed? No, there's not even a slave at the door. God of healing, please save her. This we implore. There would not be silence if she had died. They haven't yet brought the body outside. Well, it may be inside. There's a secret they're keeping. You mean there's a funeral without any weeping?"
Those are really lovely lines, Jeff. So why is there no weeping and no typical funeral elements?
Because Alcestis she's still alive. She's on her way out, but there is this liminal quality. The chorus is waiting to hear. They know that Alcestis is on her way out, but they haven't gotten the official word, and so they're doing what choruses do. They're weeping, they're wailing, they're worried.
Now the chorus goes on like this, as choruses in tragedy tend to do, and right at the end, they spot a female servant coming from the palace door.
That's right.
So here I will be reading from Dr. Arntzen's Farlian's translation a little bit. "But look, a servant's coming from the house, streaming in tears. What will I hear from her? It's natural to grieve if something's happened, but I would like to learn about your mistress. Is she living still, or has she died?"
Now, one of the things I find really interesting about this scene is how Euripides inverts what typically happens in a tragedy. And so one of the famous things about Greek tragedy, with possibly the exception of Ajax in Sophocles' play, is that people who die don't die on stage. It's the messenger who comes rushing in to tell the death story. And here, again, we have Euripides playing with expectations. We have the servant who goes on, talks a lot about Alcestis dying, saying goodbye. She says goodbye to her marriage bed. She says goodbye to her children.
It's very melodramatic.
Very melodramatic.
Filled with pathos and bathos.
Yeah, it's really over the top. When the servant ends her speech, Alcestis is still very much alive, and then what happens next is we do get an actual death scene.
We get to see Alcestis herself die on stage.
We do.
Euripides wants to reverse the typical order.
Probably something that would have irritated somebody like Aristotle. Tragedies are supposed to unfold in a particular way. They're supposed to look and sound a particular way. You have these scenes. You don't have these scenes. Again, I think we have Euripides, the experimenter, on display here.
And I've often heard it said, and I think this is a canard, I don't think this is accurate, that deaths occur off stage because the Greeks were filled with a sense of propriety or bashfulness. They thought it was somehow inappropriate to show death on stage. Hmm. I don't think really that's the operative motive here.
I agree. How do you explain Aristophanes?
Right. You know? I think that what is really happening, the proper way to understand it, is that they thought it was more powerful to hear something described than to witness it.
It's in some ways, it's like the Hitchcock theory of horror. The most terrifying things are the things that you imagine,
right,
rather than they're displayed.
Right.
Yeah.
The display of someone dying is not going to be as powerful as the description, the very careful description, where your imagination, I'm just restating what you said in different words,
yeah,
where the imagination fills in all of the colorful elements.
Right. So Euripides sets it up like a typical tragedy, and then he flips it.
Bad manager, but great tragedian, as Aristotle
exactly
would say.
Exactly as Aristotle said at the beginning, yes.
So Admetus and Alcestis, husband and wife, king and queen, they haven't yet appeared on the stage.
Not together, no.
No, so that's going to be where we pick up next week.
Yes, exactly right.
For episode 17. So Jeff, as we wrap this one up, what would you say are some of the takeaways?
My main takeaways from this episode is kind of locating Euripides in the kind of the history of tragedy, what makes Euripides unique, and how some of that uniqueness spills out into this very fascinating play. What about you, Dave?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the way that an artist can master all of the conventions of a genre, as Euripides has done, but then innovate on them in unexpected ways. So I don't like the individual artist, author, whatever the case may be, who flouts convention altogether and doesn't bother to learn the tools of the trade. That to me is lazy and sloppy. It bothers me a lot. But if a person masters all of the elements, like say grammar, but then knows how carefully and deftly to violate those conventions, that to me is really impressive.
I like that. That's,
and that seems to be what Euripides is doing.
Yeah, agreed. That's really well put. All right, we are up against the clock here. We got to get out of here. So Dave, tell our listeners some ways they can help us out.
Well, we have been so thrilled by all the support we've received thus far. More than 3,000 downloads as of the time of recording. It's bound to get higher. They don't seem to go the other way. We are so grateful. People have been leaving nice comments at Spotify and Apple iTunes and so forth. Send us an email. We've received some excellent emails.
Keep them coming.
Jeff@adnauseum.com, mostly praise for his translation. Dave@adnauseum.com, joke suggestions, dad jokes in particular. We'd love to receive those kinds of things. We also have t-shirts available now.
They're very attractive t-shirts.
Yeah, t-shirts. As I said a moment ago, these have the Ad Nauseum logo right on the center, in the front, and it says for classical gourmands. So if you like what you listen to, leave us a tip, so to speak, slip it under the wine glass, buy a t-shirt from us, can't hurt.
We can find that on the website.
Yes, on the section entitled Lurch with Merch.
Sounds great.
And Jeff, you're going to set up next week, aren't you? What's coming down the pipe?
Well, we're going to continue our look at Alcestis.
I guess that's obvious,
and,
isn't it?
Yes, and get ourselves to the rest of the play, and we're going to pick it up at this crucial moment where Alcestis and Metis show up together. Okay, that does it for this week. Dave, I believe you have our gustatory parting shot.
I do. This is our gastroclassical Fare Thee Well. It's from A.A. Milne, the famous author of Winnie the Pooh. And Milne says, "What I say is that if a man really likes potatoes, he must be a pretty decent sort of fellow."
Thanks for listening.